Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. During the March for the White House, not a great deal was said about President Barack Obama's father, nor, our guest said, did the media produce a much more detailed portrait. The story was not easy to get. The first Obama had lived a disorganized life, one of fractured pieces that seemed to have little connective tissue. In October of 2008, Sally Jacobs from the Boston Globe wrote a profile of the elder Obama for the Boston Globe. She was unable to go to Kenya, and she relied on dozens of phone interviews, email messages, text messages. In the final weeks leading up to the election, Sally resolved that if Obama made it to the White House, she would pursue the larger story. Much that was not known. How had Obama Sr., raised in the scrappy bush hundreds of miles from Nairobi, achieved the lofty heights that he did? And how did he fall so hard when he fell? So she went to Kenya, and she says not all of the Obamas were glad to see her. When the first Barack died, he left behind a chaotic domestic tangle and a darkly checkered career, and some families didn't want the story told. If it was told, they wanted one of their own to do it. So a lot of people tried to sabotage her work, but she carried on, and it's a remarkable story of how she gathered the story. Sally is a veteran reporter at the Boston Globe, covered national, international, and breaking news for over 20 years, specialized in political reporting and profiles, including Joan Kennedy, Michelle Obama, Pat Patrick, Deval Patrick's father. This is her first book. And Sally, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It is such an incredible story, Sally. I kept reading and reading and thinking, oh my gosh, this is the president's father. You must have thought that the whole time you were putting this together.
I did. I mean, I find it really sort of an extraordinary tale. His life is fascinating in itself, but the fact that he was the president's father makes it even more extraordinary. I think it's a really interesting piece of history and one that helps us to understand the president himself.
Why was it so hard to get information on him as President Obama was making the run for the White House?
Well, the real reason was because it was on the other side of the country. I mean, once you're there, it's not hard. There's lots of people that knew him, lots of people that want to talk about him. There is a long paper trail, but it's in Nairobi. And to be honest, I never really understood why anyone else hadn't done it. It was certainly a story I felt that was waiting to be told.
Tell me all that you went through to get this story. It was not an easy journey for you to make.
It wasn't an easy one. I mean, for starters, I had to spend a lot of time in Nairobi. There were many, many trips back to the village, to Lake Victoria, where he was born in 1936. It took a lot of rumbling through, you know, down rocky roads to villages. A lot of people didn't have phones. I had to have a number of assistants to make contacts for me so I knew somebody was there, that they had known him. Then we would make the journey there. So it took a lot of time. It took a lot of sitting, of tracking people down, as you mentioned. The family had sort of mixed feelings about the book. You know, he led a very conflicted life. His numerous children, there are eight total, seven surviving, had mixed feelings about them, and I think were sort of protective of the story. They didn't want the president to be tarnished by it. So I had a kind of an on-again, off-again conversation with certain family members. Some of them were wonderful and really helpful to me, took me to the village, introduced me to many people that knew the elder Obama as a child and a young man. So that was very helpful.
Two things stand out early on in his life. Number one is that he's a really smart guy. And number two, that there's an awful lot of violence. If you could explain the culture, the physical violence that took place, particularly between the husband and the wife or wives, as the case may be, just a lot of that.
Obama Sr.'s father was Anyanga Hussein, who was a rather violent person. I heard many stories about his beatings of children and his many wives. He had a famous hippopotamus whip, a four-pronged whip. And a number of Sr.'s friends can tell in painful detail what it was like to be touched by that whip. Some of his own children, Hussein Anyanga's children, tell of hiding from him. He was a very meticulous person. He himself had been quite smart and learned a great deal in Nairobi when he worked for the white man and brought all of his new knowledge back. But it came at a price. He did not want you to talk to him unless he spoke first. He had to sit down first, eat first, and he did beat many of his wives. There is a famous story told by a number of family members about his beatings of Obama Sr.'s mother. And there came a time when he was very angry at her and threatened to kill her. He went outside and dug her grave behind the house and was about to cut her throat when a neighbor happened to notice that and said, "You must stop." And he did, but she later ran away.
And going ahead to the toward the end of the book, Barack Obama's father threatens his third wife, I think it is, or is it his fourth wife, Ruth, who follows him to Africa, and he's about to kill her.
Yes, he was very angry with her. It was his third wife, and he did abuse her. I hear this not just from her and one of her children, but neighbors could hear Obama Sr. yelling at her, threatening to hit her, and a time came when he did hit her, and when he once laid a hand on one of their two children, Ruth decided it was time to go, and shortly after that, she did leave him.
Mm-hmm. But he is very smart, and he becomes educated by Missionaries Christian School.
Yes, he goes to a series of Christian schools. At the time, education was a very exceptional thing. Not all children got an education by a long shot. Obama Sr. was extraordinarily smart. He did go to school. He walked many miles to get there, but he was quickly identified, as one teacher described him to me, as the smartest boy in the class. He was so smart that he often sort of ignored his studies. He wouldn't take a test. He wouldn't study for a test till the last minute, wouldn't do papers till the 11th hour, and then he could do them in a breeze. He wound up at a very prominent school for the sons of Luo chiefs called the Maseno School, and he also excelled there, at least until they asked him to leave.
And why did they ask him to leave?
Because he argued so much. You say yes, he says no. He would challenge teachers. He would disobey the rules. They want you to dry your dishes. He laid them out in the sun. You're not supposed to walk on the green grass. He lay down in the middle of it. The prefect says, get up. You need to do X. He refuses to do it. And they were tired of it. It culminated, I believe, in a letter. An anonymous letter was received by the head of the school complaining about the teachers, not fit to teach. The food wasn't good. The beds were too hard. Now, it wasn't signed, but they pretty much knew it was him or thought it was him. And they asked him to leave the school. This was a real defeat for him because it meant he couldn't go on to the next stage of education, and it caused him problems down the road.
Until he finds Ms. Mooney, a very interesting relationship outlined in the book.
Yes, Betty Mooney is one of my favorite characters in the whole story. She was a literacy teacher in Nairobi. She had come via Texas, Maryland, a number of stops along the way. And she was really taken with him. He was so smart, and he was so eager to go to the United States. She hired him to work in her office. He translated text. And then she helped him identify a school he wanted to go to, which, as we know, is the University of Hawaii. They found it in a Saturday Evening Post magazine together. And she helped him take the tests he needed to take and even paid for his first year of school. They were very close.
How close were they?
You know, some in Nairobi speculate they may have had a romantic relationship. I myself think it's unlikely. She was quite religious. Her own parents had divorced, and I think she would not have gone down that road. But I do think she was taken with him. I found many letters she wrote about him, and she admired him, and she really had great hopes for him.
And he was already married at this point, wasn't he?
He was already married. He had one child before he left, and his wife, Kezia, was pregnant when he flew to the United States in 1959.
This seems to be a pattern with him, and it's hard for me to understand this, so you can fill us in. He has these huge commitments that normally people make. They get married, they have children, they take care of the children, and he just keeps having children and going from one woman to the next woman to the next woman. He has a picture of the now president that he carries with him, but this utter lack of regard for what your responsibilities are.
Well, an important thing to understand about Obama Sr. is that he was a Luo. This was the ethnic group, the tribe that he came from, and it was a polygamous one. Having multiple wives was very common. If he had not had multiple wives, if a person didn't, that would have been unusual. So the fact that he married, had four wives, was not in itself unusual, but the way he did it was different. Most Luos live in a traditional compound. All the wives live together in one place, different houses, but in one location. Obama Sr. was a serial marrier. You know, he went from one to the next and often didn't tell the second one about the first one. You know, many of his wives wondered how many people he was married to, as did immigration officials. So in that sense, it was kind of a mystery to many people how many people he was married to. And yes, he did not take much care of his many children, although he did keep that small photograph.
So was it his goal to come back and really help his country? And if so, in what way?
Obama's great passion of his life, I believe, was Kenya. He was deeply, deeply committed to that country and wanted nothing more than to go back and be a significant figure there, to help to develop this new country, to help develop the economy, and really to reclaim Kenya from the British for Kenyans. When the politics began to go astray, when Jomo Kenyatta began to drift to the right, he became very upset about that, and that created more problems for him. But yes, that was his dream, and he wanted to create this country.
The other thing that really runs strongly in this book, you write early on in the book, a schoolmate of his who worked in government ministries and served as a member of the Kenyan parliament, he didn't do anything wrong particularly. He just didn't finish the race. As schoolboys, we were always taught that you must finish the race no matter what, but he didn't. He just collapsed.
Right. Well, in the end, that's what happened. You know, Obama goes back to Kenya in 64. He gets a series of jobs over the next 4 or 5 years, and one after the other, he loses them. Finally, he's fired from the KTDC, the Kenya Tourist Development Corp, in 1971, because he lies. He pretends to be his own boss. He gets drunk on the job. He doesn't show up. He also is very brilliant. He's excellent at his numbers. He's good. So in the end, they do finally let him go, and he begins a period of drift, what I think of as his lost years, 4 or 5 years. Ultimately, he does get a job again in 1975, the end of 75, but it's a low job. It's a planner's job in the Treasury, and that is where he stays until he dies.
I was struck, Sally, by how early he started drinking heavily. I hadn't heard the story at the University of Hawaii. He'd be out with people and he would just pass out at the table. And he's a young man at this point.
Well, the interesting thing is about that is that I don't think he drank to his full capacity in the United States as he did back in Nairobi. Obama kept a little bit of a lid on it while he was there. Yes, he drank, and yes, he partied and passed out at the table. But when he went home, he let out all the stops. I think he had been somewhat guarded in the United States, aware that immigration had an eye on him. Harvard and the University of Hawaii had an eye on him. He goes back and to Kenya, and this is a time of great celebration. Kenyans are celebrating. They have their country at long last. Africans can get jobs. They get fancy cars. There's money to be had. It's a great moment. And he drinks hard. His nickname was Double Double, and the reason for that was that when he went into a bar, he would order a double shot of his favorite liquor, which was Johnny Walker Black, followed by a chaser of two more shots. So that's four shots just to open the door. Friends say he could order four times that much, up to 16 shots at one sitting. That's a lot of alcohol.
And he became a belligerent drunk.
He was not always a pleasant person to be around, as Kenya became a more complex place to be politically, a place where dissent was not brooked. He became an angrier person and often would rail against Kenyatta, rail against the Kikuyu, the other tribe that held the predominant number of positions, and he would say so quite publicly, which was something that many people didn't do. Many people were more careful.
Why did he choose Hawaii?
He chose Hawaii for many reasons, I think. Reading the Saturday Post piece, which I was able to find, it describes Hawaii, A, as a place of great natural beauty. It also had many women of great natural beauty. They had multiple beauty pageants. There was a great variety of ethnic groups. I think all of that appealed to him. He had a little bit of a problem that he hadn't gotten the required degree, the required Cambridge certificate. University of Hawaii allowed people to come without that piece of paper, and that also was a plus to him. But the place appealed to him culturally for many reasons.
Mm-hmm. Although he did think, I think you read at one point, that he thought that some of his fellow students were not studious enough.
Well, once he got there, of course, Obama being Obama, he found fault. The city wasn't quite as big as he thought it would be. The students weren't up to snuff. Good God, people wore flip-flops. They were walking around, as he would say, in the spit of another man. So it didn't quite make the grade, but he migrated to the East-West Center. He wasn't a student there, but he hung out with a lot of the people there. This was a program that attracted many international students, and they were older in some respects and more worldly, and he felt very much at home with them.
So tell us about the moment, and I believe he's an hour late, for the first date with Obama's mother, Anne.
He meets her in a Russian class. Russian was very popular at the time and was apparently very smitten with her. And arranges to meet her in front of a building for a date, is an hour late, and comes there and marvels at her with some of his other friends. And the rest is history in that relationship.
Yeah. And it is a pretty striking thing. Tell us a little bit more about her and her parents. We know some about them. But what year we're talking about, and the fact that he's a man from Africa, and there weren't very many men from Africa in Hawaii, even though there was more interracial socializing going on than in other parts of the states, it still was a fairly dramatic story.
Yes, it was a very unusual relationship and extraordinary on both parts, particularly hers. You know, she had had a rather protected upbringing in Seattle. She had come to Hawaii in 59, and they meet in a class in 1960. It was extraordinary. He was the only first African student there. There were not many more the following year. Mixed marriage was still against the law in quite a number of states. And even to be walking down the street with an African would raise eyebrows. They went to an island. They left Honolulu to get married the following year in February of 61. Nobody was told about it. Certainly none of their friends were aware of it. Some people thought it was very romantic that they spent the money to go away. Other people thought they did it so they wouldn't be detected. You know, she was pregnant at the time. So it was rather extraordinary.
But there was still an element of doubt, thinking that perhaps, who had the doubt, that he was from another country and there was some concern about her future.
You mean concern that she had, or?
No, concern that maybe she would leave, or concern that the child wouldn't be accepted in American society. Did anybody raise that kind of doubt?
Well, the parents, both of their parents were not particularly happy about it. Certainly Obama Sr.'s father was quite irate and wrote a letter to him saying this was not a good idea. And her own parents initially were skeptical about it. You know, time passed and her parents got on board and accepted the fact and, of course, took great care of their grandchild. But in the beginning, I think everybody was quite concerned about it.
It was so short-lived, wasn't it? It was just almost a moment in time and then he was gone.
Well, I think it was even shorter than we've realized. In general, people have thought they lived together until he goes to Harvard in 1962. But according to some of the immigration records that I found, he had not been living with her even shortly after Obama Jr. was born. So, yes, it was extremely short. And by 1962, he's offered a number of scholarships at different schools, and he makes a choice not to take the one that would have enabled him to travel with his wife and young child to New York to go to school there. He decides to go to Cambridge, to Harvard, because, of course, it was the best, and an Obama had to have the best. So he leaves his young family behind.
And did he write to them at all? Was there any thought about trying to get them to go with him, or did he just not even think about that?
Well, I don't know a great deal about any correspondence between them. There was apparently some because I found folks in Hawaii who, in talking to Ann Dunham, she was aware that he was dating some other people. She understood him to be a polygamist. It wasn't that that upset her so much. It was that he wasn't sending her money, that he was spending money on dates when he should have, she thought, been sending it to him. And it was that that upset her, and she soon after filed for divorce.
Mm-hmm. And did he have the same pattern? Was he not sending money back to Africa to his first wife?
He was sending some money back, not a great deal. But in that case also, Grace Kazia was having difficulties. She had two children by this point. She was making great efforts to improve herself. She knew her husband was going to be coming home from Harvard. She was taking classes in Nairobi and very excited about him coming back. Meantime, he had found yet another wife, to her great dismay.
So she didn't know about Anne.
She did not know about Anne. She did know about Anne, I'm sorry. He did write back and tell them. She did not know about the third wife until he came back.
Oh, my. It's hard to keep track of
it
all of it,
isn't
it? I know, all the kids and everything. And the stories of what happened to them are also interesting. We're welcoming phone calls. Sally Jacobs is our guest this hour. Her new book is it's her first book, The Other Barack, The Bold and Reckless Life of President Obama's Father. Sally is a veteran reporter at the Boston Globe, has covered national, international, and breaking news for over two decades. This is her first book, and she did travel, it's some discomfort to herself to Kenya to really get this story and to meet with the extended members of the Obama family and tell some fascinating stories. So the story itself of who our president's father was is pretty compelling. Here's our number if you'd like to join our conversation. Maybe a few of you have had a chance to read the book, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Other Barack, our subject this hour, again, our number is 800-486-8655. Joanne from Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Very interesting conversation with the author about the book, The Other Barack. My question is, why is this book coming out now as we go into the next election? Is there some reason, is there something to this timing, or should we not read anything into that?
You mean why is the book being released now?
Yeah. Is there something about the timing going into the next election, or should we not read anything into that?
Absolutely nothing to do with that. It took me this long to write it. I had to go travel quite a deal. Would love to have come out earlier, but it took a while to get the information.
Okay, so the people who are going to say, oh, my goodness, President Barack Obama's father was a person that we have lots of questions about, those are going to be raised as the election goes on. You're not concerned that you're going to be asked a lot of questions along those lines?
You know, that's a good question. It did occur to me that, you know, people would attempt to tag the president, to tar him with the misdeeds of his father. His father was a very complicated character, obviously. What, in fact, I think has come of this is that it really makes the president's journey all the more extraordinary. You know, he came from one very dysfunctional parent and a somewhat absent mother, and he became the president of the United States. I think, really, it shows what a determination he has had, that he has created himself and achieved the highest rank in the country. In many ways, it is a laudable situation, not one that you could criticize him for.
I'm sorry. Have you offered the book to the president to read? Have you heard anything from the White House about it?
Nope, I have heard nothing from him.
Okay.
I'd be very interested to know what he thinks of it.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Joanne. Don't you think he would have to have read it or be in the process of reading it? Yeah, how could you not?
I would think so. I mean, obviously, he's very interested or has been interested in who his father was. He made quite an effort to learn about him. He also, as I read his memoir, made a decision, you know, not to go much farther. He could have found many of the things that I found, but I think at some point he realized his father wasn't the man he had been told throughout his childhood. He was something quite different, and he wrestled with that and came to terms with it. I don't know how much more he wants to know. I would presume he would be interested, but who knows how anybody deals with a situation like this.
Yeah. So really the only contact they had for any length of time, and this is just a flash of time, was the month when he was, 10 years old, and his father came to Hawaii to spend a month with him, and it didn't go very swimmingly.
Right. That was exactly right. He had left when he was 1 year old. He comes back for that month in 1971, and according to the president's memoir, by the end of that visit, he was ready for him to leave. His father seemed bossy. People were beginning to argue, and he writes in real detail of how his father refuses to let him watch his cherished Christmas program and orders him to go do his homework. You know, they were tired of him. They did write later, according to the president's memoir. They exchanged letters over the course of years. I was not able to get those letters, but at some point they too ended. That communication ended.
We go to Virginia in Janesville. Hi, Virginia.
You just started to talk about it. I am interested in the comparison between her book and the one Obama wrote, because it always interested me that with all the strong women in his life, he felt the need to, I don't know, dream about this man. Maybe he felt he had to write about it because otherwise people would bring it up as a slur against him. But I remember from his book, he talked about his grandmother, the woman who really raised him, as being a racist because she complained about being attacked at a bus stop when she was going to work to support both him and his grandfather. And I always wondered why he didn't relate more to those strong women who raised him.
Well, I remember the bus incident. I don't remember him calling her a racist, per se. I myself think he does identify with these strong women. I think those were his role models in many respects. His grandfather certainly was also. But I think he does identify with them, and that's where I think he got much of his determination and his ability to achieve what he did.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about it's hard to keep track of all the stepbrothers and sisters, but tell me about the contact he has had with them, their thoughts about him. It must be quite something to have a member of your family be mm-hmm. the leader of the free world. You know, the people who are living in a slum in Nairobi, for heaven's sake. What outreach has he had? What interest has he had in tracing those roots?
Yeah. I think they're all extremely proud of him, as you would be. Of course, some know him better than others. He has had contact with some of the older siblings. One or two he did not know until he ran for the presidency. You know, in each case, it's been a different situation. The youngest one, excuse me, George, who lives in Nairobi, has met him several times, but then subsequently has had no contact. I think he's been disappointed by that. The older ones, the oldest brother and sister, I think are in some contact with him. So it really varies across the board.
Thanks, Virginia, very much for the call. Gay is next in Madison. Hi, Gay.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on the first caller's question just a teeny bit, and that is the timing of this seems curious to me, and I don't know whether I'm allowed to ask you, the author, what your personal opinion is of Barack Obama, the president, but also I can imagine, I shudder as I listen to this, because I can imagine people who are of a certain cast of mind saying, see there, you know, this is just like the typical, you know, black family where the mother has forced to raise a child whose father's irresponsible. My read on it is that it made him a better man, a stronger man, and almost heroic to rise above this kind of situation. But I fear how this will read to many people, and I wonder what you have to say about that.
Well, as I said, you know, it occurs to me that, yeah, sure, a critic could say, oh, look, the president has this terrible father. He drank all the time, had all these marriages. Boy, but what does that have to do with the president? He never knew his father.
Exactly.
How could that possibly be used to taint him, really? On the contrary, it occurs to me that here he had a father who was quite dysfunctional and quite self-absorbed, and he became the president. You know, love him or hate him, whatever your politics, the man created himself the president created himself out of a quite chaotic childhood and a father who clearly was not present and was self-destructive. So I don't really see how you could criticize him. How could you use this against him?
Yeah, there are people, though, who have, and they started early on criticizing you. You write about several months after you started work, somebody, tell me who, started this email campaign against you saying that you were a Republican collaborator bent on bringing the president down and preventing him from running for another term. Many, you write, did, though, understand your interest had nothing to do with politics and everything to do with expanding the historic record.
Yes, but as you recall, the person that made that statement was not a Republican. It was the president's grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
It was his own family member who said that. And the reason that she did that, I'm sorry, it was his aunt, not his grandmother, the reason that she did that was because I think she wanted to tell the story herself.
Mm.
I think she was trying to quiet family members from talking. Fortunately, we got beyond that, and people realized that this was not a political book. This was a book of history and biography.
Right, which is definitely what it is. It's a book of history, and it's good to know more about who this person is. I'm amazed that, I mean, you've done a wonderful job with this, but it is interesting that nobody really picked on heavily on this story, other than just making, you know, comments about what they think he was
mm-hmm.
and who the president was and this goofy stuff about, you know, where he was born and all of that. Nobody really did the history of this, and it's an absolutely fascinating story.
Well, I feel gratified by that, to be honest. It did occur to me that people might try to use it to tar him. It would be difficult to do for the reasons
right.
I just described. But, you know, the truth is this book is all about understanding history, the presidency, and what has happened, how he got there. This is the first black president. It's important to understand why it happened, how it happened, and what are the elements of it. And my hope is that this book will go contribute to the historic record in a significant way in understanding that. I think that people see the book that way. If it were seen as a political thing,
right.
Yes, it would be talked about more
right.
in a negative way and used. But it's not that kind of a book.
No.
You know, I think the book goes to great lengths not to criticize or to tar Obama Sr. He was what he was. It's a book that tries to understand his life in the context of the political time, into the context of his own culture and the domestic violence that he was exposed to.
Right. And people also have to think about who you are. You're a veteran reporter for the Boston Globe. You've covered politics and for years and years and years. I mean, people have to have respect for who you are.
Well, the fact is that the book is extensively documented. You
mm-hmm.
know, I did hundreds of interviews. I was able to get documents reflecting his entire work career. I interviewed his bosses, many figures of some substance in Kenya who talked about him. So it's not the kind of book that talks to a couple people that did or didn't like him.
Was he ever, let's spend a little more time on what was going on politically in Kenya and whether he was able to fulfill in any measure his dream of making his country stronger, a better place for its citizens?
Well, yes and no, I guess, is the answer to that. He comes back to Nairobi and gets a job at Shell. That job doesn't last. He moves on to the central bank short term there and goes to the Kenya's Tourist Development Corporation. During these years, the early years of Kenyan independence, Kenya is shifting to the right, politically speaking. Jomo Kenyatta, the president, has a very tight control on the country and is beginning to make decisions about the economy. He's allowing foreign investment, privatization of land, property is getting amassed in the hands of fewer than larger. And Obama Sr. was very upset about this. He wanted his country for Kenyans. He wanted some foreign investment, but not too much. He wrote an article quite critical of the economics of the time and what was happening, and that, too, was a very bold act. Kenyatta did not accept criticism. He did not tolerate it and was not happy when people spoke out against him. Obama went ahead and wrote a very detailed analysis and critique of the competing political factions of the time. And I think Kenyatta was not particularly happy about that. So long answer to Obama expressed himself, said what he thought, but did not make any real substantive change in the direction of the country.
If he had been able to handle his drinking problem, if he had that taken care of, could he have gone a lot farther in Kenyan politics, do you think, considering how smart he was?
He absolutely could have been a more successful person. I don't think he would ever have been a political creature in the sense of running for office. That wasn't his way. He was much more of an intellectual, not someone who had much respect for the common man, politically speaking. But yes, to this day, there are economists in Kenya who speak very highly of him. One of his bosses in particular, a prominent economist named Harris Mulay, and I'll tell you this story as an example of the impact of his drinking, Obama's, that is, not Mulay's, remembers Obama when he was working in the Treasury and says that at times Obama would get stuck because he hadn't had a drink. His mind just didn't work that well. And so Mulay would say, look, here's some shillings. Go down to Tina's. This is his favorite bar. And get yourself a drink and come back. And that's exactly what he did. He'd go have a few shots. He'd come back and he'd be ready to roll.
Oh, my. Thanks, Gay, for the call. We go to Jeanette in Ladysmith. Hi, Jeanette.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
In listening to all of this, it has occurred to me, in terms of could this be used against our president, and certainly there are those who it would not matter. The man could walk on water, and they would find reason to fault him. If we were to look at American history, this is not new in terms of even presidents. Three come to mind just right off the top of my head, Kennedy, Jefferson, and Bush, in terms of their families of origin and the way they lived. This is not new stuff for the White House, nor is it new stuff for our society, which leads me to a question that I really don't know the answer to. In the time of which we're speaking, the time frame, what was the stance on polygamy in Kenya? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Sally?
Yes. Do you want me to answer that?
Yes, please.
What was the stance of polygamy in Kenya at the time?
Right.
Polygamy was widely practiced amongst the Luos. It was a very common thing. certainly things were changing in Nairobi, but many men did have multiple wives.
Mm-hmm. And that started changing?
Well, I mention that because what Obama said was that he had divorced his wife. Divorce was not very common, his first wife. Divorce was not very common amongst the Luo. It required a complex process. You had to go before a council of elders, that kind of thing. The change in Obama's view of the world at some points was that you didn't have to go through that process. You could just say, I'm divorced. You tell your wife, I'm divorced. Many people didn't agree with that. Now, he says he told Grace Kazia that they were going to be divorced, but she says he never told her that. And she was married to him all his life. So my point is just that marriage, polygamy, who's married to who, was a little bit in flux at the time as social mores changed when people moved to the cities.
You write about the story of the president's father lying only partly in human memory. You did, and I want you to tell us what you found, several repositories of documents that looked at windows on his life in Kenya and the 6 years when he lived in the United States. What are those documents?
Sure. The main thing I found, and there were several batches, the most revealing to me was his INS file. Every person who came to this country as a student and visiting person, they kept what's called an alien file, an A file. I FOIA'd that, and I found a vast amount of information about his status here, memos about what they thought about his polygamous behavior, his multiple wives, thoughts about deporting him, letters from Harvard where they finally do ask him to leave because they're not happy about his multiple marriages. So that was the main one. In Kenya, in the archives there, I found all the minutes of his time at the KTDC. Again, this was the tourist development agency from which he was finally forced to leave. That also was very revealing. There were detailed minutes of every meeting in which they discuss him, his lying, his drinking, that kind of thing. And finally, at the Treasury, I was able to get his employment record there. This was a later aspect of his life in the 70s and early 80s when it chronicles his constant need for money, his drinking, and his deterioration there also.
Did he commit suicide?
I don't think so. Some people think he might have, friends of his. Family members thought he had been killed because of his outspokenness, his criticism of the government. Many family members feel that he was forced off the road, car was rigged, whatever. I do not. He was at a place in his life where he had found some peace. He had just had his eighth child. He had a job and claimed he was going to have a promotion soon. I found no evidence of that. But I don't think he would have killed himself. I just don't think that was in the cards for him.
It's hard to imagine this, but it's just hard to imagine as you read this book that his son became president of the United States. You wonder what he would have thought of that, don't you?
Well, as Neil Abercrombie, the now governor of Hawaii, always says or said to me, Obama Sr., whom he knew at the university, would have said, well, of course, he's my son.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Right. That seems very likely considering this story. Oh,
exactly.
My. More phone calls in a moment. Sally Jacobs is our guest. Her book is The Other Barack, The Bold and Reckless Life of President Obama's Father. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Terry in Rice Lake. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if this book put a kibosh to the birther question.
I think the book states fairly clearly that he was born in Honolulu and does indeed put an end to that question. Immigration records describe his birth there, and I don't think that's an issue.
Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Jomo Kenyatta was connected a bit with America when he was in Britain as Johnstone Kenyatta. He and Paul Robeson were involved in the Scots for Defense Committee to defend young black men accused of rape in Alabama in the 1930s. Kenyatta went to Kenya eventually and becomes Jomo and is involved in the Mau Mau, the uprising against the British Empire. And what, you know, the Obama family, how do they fit with the Mau Mau and the uprising against the British?
All right, you write about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, several things. Obama Sr. really missed that generation. He doesn't get into Nairobi until 56, 57, and this is after much of the violence has happened. Yes, the state of emergency is still in place, but he was a little too late for that. He was in a Maseno school and somewhat removed from Mau Mau issues. There is some mention that his own father, Anyanga Hussein, was in prison, but his imprisonment incurred in 49 before the detention camps were built. So it's not really clear to me whether that was a consequence of Mau Mau. Anyanga Hussein himself also spoke up quite a bit. He was critical of some of the British practices of collecting taxes, et cetera, and I think that's what got him into trouble. But I think that was a little bit peripheral to Mau Mau.
Talk more. We didn't discuss this when we talked about the papers you found, the long paper trail that you found, letters that he had written to the Kenyan nationalist, Tom Mboya, stored at Stanford.
Yes, Obama was very close to Tom Mboya. Mboya was a little bit older than him, but they had many things in common. They both were Luos. They both were men that loved women, liked to go out dancing in Nairobi. So they had a lot that they shared. He did write letters to him, updating him on where he was at, what he was doing, about his plans for when he came back. Interestingly, he did not get on the airlift that Tom Mboya sponsored. He sponsored a number of airlifts bringing students to the United States to get an education, so that they would be equipped to go back to Nairobi and create their country. Obama was turned down, despite his friendship with Tom, because he didn't have that piece of paper, the Cambridge school certificate that he needed, as a result of what happened to him at Maseno. But he did keep constant tabs on Tom, and the two stayed in touch.
Thank you, Hugh, for the call. Connie in Madison, hi.
Hi. A friend of mine who was an exchange professor in law schools in East Africa said that some of his friends at the time that Barack Obama was running for president marveled that the United States might have a Luo president before Kenya ever did. Could you describe the tribal structure of Kenya and describe the relative position of the Luo in its tribal structure? And further, could you help Americans understand how individuals from one tribe versus another can be differentiated within the society? Is it by phenotype? Is it by name? Is it by some other means? And I think that pretty much wraps my question.
All right, Connie, there's a good question. Thanks.
Yes, that comment about the Luo president was often made in Kenya, that there would be a Luo president here before there was there. You know, I'm not an expert on the tribal structure. There are 40-some ethnic groups there. The Luos are the third largest, or they generally have been. Sometimes they're the fourth, depending on who's counting. And they're identified by a host of ways. Yes, by language. Yes, by characteristics, appearance, across the board. There's many different ways to identify them. In terms of tribal rivalries, as many people know, the Kikuyu have been dominant for many years during the Kenyatta era. There have been many rivalries that have continued from those early differences that color politics to this day.
And thank you, Connie, for your call. Karen and Galena, hi.
Hi. Hi, Kathleen. Love your show. Love this program. I'm so delighted that this lady has done such wonderful research. I find myself coming into contact lately with people who tell me that No one knows Barack Obama when he was at Columbia. His pictures aren't in any of the yearbooks at Harvard or Columbia. It blows my mind that there are people out there who keep saying these things, and no matter what you tell them, they keep saying, oh, no one knew him. So thank you for doing all this great research and making it available for people. It's just incredible that people want to have nothing, can't dig up any dirt on him, so they're creating these doubts about him. That's the way I feel about it.
Yeah, and you just have to dismiss them, don't you? I mean, people who go so way off base. I'm interested more in the process that you went through. I know that you got sick, you got pneumonia a couple times when you did this book. You had salmonella. It was an arduous journey for you.
Well, like any reporting adventure, you know, you have to just kind of keep going. I broke a couple of ribs from coughing. I did have pneumonia a couple times. I did get salmonella poisoning at one of the fanciest hotels in the city, but isn't that the way? So, you know, it was, I mentioned that because it was a physically, you know, a physically demanding process in some ways. We did travel to the lake many times and walked into, you know, fairly remote locations a lot, but that's what you had to do to get the story.
And you did find, for the most part, that family members were willing to talk to you. There, many were very hospitable.
Yes, we went to the village of Kanyajiang, which is where Obama Sr. was born, and there are many, many Obamas there. Two of his first cousins were wonderfully helpful to me. Their father was brother to Obama Sr.'s father. Sorry, I know that's very complex. But yes, the village was very welcoming to me. We spent a number of days there and interviewed many people who had known Sr. There are also a number of family members here in the United States. So while there were some who did not talk to me, a couple of the children did, some did not. I felt like I had a very deep exposure to people in the family.
Yeah, and it did take, tell me about how long it took to do this book. Did you start in 2008?
I did. As soon as he won, as soon as he was nominated, I began and went to London first off to interview his first wife, Grace Kazia. And then I reported for about a little over, I'd say a year and a quarter, and then started to write. So it did take about 2 years.
And tell me about his first wife.
Grace Kazia, he met when she was, I believe, 17. They were at a Christmas dance in 1957. He was somewhat older, and she was very smitten with him. They got married shortly afterwards. They had a tribal wedding. There was a dowry of 16 cows. And she kind of rode the waves of his life. She waits for him. She has these two children. He comes back with his third wife, having fathered another child in the United States. You know, it was kind of a chaotic experience. She was thinking that he would come back and they would have a fairly traditional life, but they didn't. You know, as I mentioned earlier, in a Luo household, all the wives would live together. She was ready to do that when he came back. But Ruth, his third wife, was from Newton, a white woman from Newton, Massachusetts, and she had no intention of having another wife living in the house. Absolutely refused. But Grace Kazia says that they made contact. She says that they had two more children together while he lived with Ruth. Others do not believe that. A judge has said that's not true, that those children are not hers. So it is in itself a kind of a chaotic domestic situation, but she still claims that they were married at the time that he died.
And he had two children with Ruth?
He had two children with Ruth, one of whom died in a motorcycle accident, oh. The other of whom is alive in China today.
Oh, he's the one in China.
Right.
This is just amazing how this story is all over the world, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It's an astonishing chronicle. You know, Mark is very interesting for many reasons. He had suffered quite a bit at the hand of his father. I think was you know, very intimidated, afraid of him,
mm-hmm.
And had a lot of trouble with the Obama name. Didn't use the name for many, many years because he associated it with a father whom he had experienced as quite brutal. But then there's that name again. The Obama name is everywhere as he's running for president, and Mark gets to know his brother a little bit and sort of opens his mind to it. And ultimately, he wrote a memoir about his experience. He ultimately takes the name on, not in any way to claim, you know, fame or fortune from it, but simply to embrace his own roots. At last, he could take that name for himself, which I think was rather amazing. And I think it's really helped him come to terms with some of the trauma of his own childhood.
Hmm.
That's just one of the eight stories.
And are there other stories where the Obama name is used in whatever way you may want to outline to achieve fame and fortune?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's lots of Obamas in the world, and I, you know, some people have tried to use the name with not a great amount of success. So, yes, of course, that happens.
And tell me what it was. You've done profiles of a lot of very interesting people for the Boston Globe. What was it that made you go to this great amount of work and this great travel experience and a long process of discovering for history who this man was? Why did you? Why him? Why this guy?
Mm-hmm. I have done a lot of profiles. I find that a really useful way to look at a life, to look at a time. It's a very linear, obvious structure. So I find it helpful from a writer's standpoint, from a research standpoint. This, to me, was a story just waiting to be told. You know, here was the father. Here was the black in the black president.
Yes, right.
So someone needed to figure out who that person was. It just seemed so obvious. We knew quite a bit about the mother. The president had written about her. She was a domestic. She was gettable. She was knowable. We understood what Seattle meant. We understood what high school meant. But who knew what where Luo's come from, what it was like to be there, what it was like to have that kind of a life when independence came, all of it. It just seemed to me to be a great story.
And did you come away with any measure of respect for this man?
Of course. Look, for all the personal failings he may have, he achieved something quite extraordinary. Barack Obama Sr. Was born in a deeply poor, deprived part of Africa. He went barefoot to school. If you had shoes at that time, you didn't wear them. You saved them for special occasions. You certainly wouldn't wear them out walking to school. He went from that kind of an experience to Harvard University. He came within inches of getting his Ph.D. in economics, and the only reason he didn't get it was because Harvard decided he had too many wives, not enough money, and they sent him home. It was a heartbreaker that he didn't get it, but he should have gotten it. And that is a monumental achievement, frankly.
Yeah.
He was very, very bright. He was a very passionate person. You know, he was brought down by a number of failings and experiences, not of his own doing altogether.
Hmm. What a story. What a story. Sally, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Sally Jacobs, the book is The Other Barack, The Bold and Reckless Life of President Obama's Father. We thank her for being with us. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning. I'm falling off my chair here. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Great conversations ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.